This is The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Kavita Puri. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. It was nearly six in the evening on December the 30th, 2019, and Li Wenliang, a Chinese doctor, was worried. He typed a private message on a chat group to his friends from medical school. He wrote, "There's been seven confirmed cases of SARS from the local seafood market in Wuhan." SARS was the deadly virus that had struck in 2002. He warned his friends not to share these messages and to take precautions. But screenshots of his warnings soon circulated on Chinese social media. Days later, Dr. Wenliang was summoned by local police and reprimanded for making false accusations and disturbing public order. He was threatened with further punishment if he repeated the rumours. He went back to his patients without personal protective equipment. 5 weeks later, he was dead from the very virus he'd warned of. He was 34. We all know what happened next. That SARS-like illness was a different coronavirus, COVID-19. It's now spread across the world, killing hundreds of thousands of people. And the blame game has started. As deaths mount in the United States, President Donald Trump tweeted, "The incompetence of China did this mass worldwide killing." He's claimed the virus started in a lab in Wuhan. Others point to China's unregulated markets, letting wildlife spread the virus. And then there's the silencing of doctors, like Li Wenliang. So this week, we ask, how far could the Chinese government be blamed for COVID-19?
Part 1. Censored.
Has been a roller coaster kind of ride, you know, all the ups and downs.
Our first expert witness is Didi Tang. She's the Beijing correspondent for the Times of London newspaper. Back in late December, she remembers seeing a screenshot of Dr. Li Wenliang's messages, but then the post
got removed from the Chinese social media. That speaks of the effectiveness of China's censorship. Once there's an order to remove something, it just vanishes. It's poof, it's gone.
She says under Chinese law, every social media user has to give their real identity so the government can trace who says what online.
They have an army of censors to look over the posts to make sure, you know, nothing is going to offend the government.
And even using certain words can alert the censors. So what raised suspicion in Li Wenliang's case?
The word SARS alarmed the system.
What's so wrong with posting on social media that there could be this infectious disease? Surely the right reaction is not to suppress, but actually investigate and protect its citizens.
I think that's sort of the logic way to think, isn't it? But, you know, that's not the case here in China. Beijing government puts a lot of emphasis on stability. It just doesn't want to have any kind of disruption.
Didi Tang says she's not sure at this stage how much the central government actually knew and suggests that a cover-up could have happened on a local level in Wuhan.
Local officials, they have incentive, right, to cover it up because they don't want to alarm the central government. They don't want to be seen as incompetent, allowing some sort of epidemic to spread. So probably they were trying to cover this one up. They were hoping it could go away on its own.
Health authorities for the province tried to make it sound that nothing was going on and that there were only a handful of coronavirus cases and, crucially, no human-to-human transmission was reported. But by mid-January, there were starting to be cases reported outside China. The country was approaching the Chinese New Year.
It's like a Christmas, right? It was a huge deal. And if you were telling people you cannot travel to go home, I mean, the public was going to be angry about that.
Airports, train stations and bus terminals were cleaned. temperature checkpoints were introduced in Wuhan, so if you had a fever, you couldn't leave. But the government didn't close Chinese borders, and millions were on the move.
Maybe for them, they thought that was a good balance, but as we know, that wasn't enough.
Suddenly, the messaging changed. China's National Health Commission confirmed what doctors in Wuhan had already suspected: human-to-human transmission of the virus.
And I think that was the time I put on my mask.
She says things then moved quickly. Days later, on the 23rd of January, the Chinese government took the drastic step of sealing off Wuhan and its 9 million residents. Didi Tang acknowledges whistleblowers were silenced, and there was some sort of cover-up, most likely at a local level. The timeline isn't clear, she says, when exactly the Chinese government knew about COVID-19 and when they took action to contain it. But China can't take all the blame, she believes. Other countries have the advantage over China. They could have prepared.
Every government has to ask themselves, ask the leadership, what did you do in early stages when you had the first cases of coronavirus? What was your response? Were you complacent enough to think it's not going to affect us?
Part 2. Roadkill.
I became interested in China quite coincidentally.
This is Professor Kevin Carrico, a senior lecturer in Chinese studies at Monash University in Melbourne.
I signed up for a Chinese class, and about half of my adult life has been spent in China.
One of the main theories on the origin of coronavirus focuses on one location, a wet market in Wuhan called the Huanan Seafood Market. While some Western media rush to point the finger, there's nothing unusual or wrong about wet markets. They're found all over East Asia. They sell fresh produce like meat and fish.
Some markets can be as simple as a place that sells fresh vegetables. Some other markets can be considerably darker and more disturbing.
The more disturbing markets are involved in the wildlife trade. They sell live animals on site, where they're slaughtered on purchase. Professor Carrico lived down the road from one in Guangzhou and passed it every day. He can still remember the smell.
Like roadkill on the side of the road that sits outside for too long in the summer.
In these markets that traded wildlife, animals were kept in cages and stacked tightly on top of one another.
Urinating and defecating on each other, allowing for the spread of disease, plus the emphasis upon on-the-spot slaughter, with often minimal protective equipment, with various liquids, bodily fluids flowing along the floor, really creates an unfortunately ideal situation for the spread of fatal viruses.
Do you think it's likely that COVID-19 did emerge from a wet market?
The general consensus seems to be that this virus originated in bats, was subsequently transmitted to pangolins in a wet market context.
Pangolins are mammals with hard scales that look a bit like anteaters. The consumption of them is believed in Chinese medicine to cure conditions like erectile dysfunction. They're an endangered species, but continue to be sold in some wet markets, including Wuhan's Huanan Seafood Market. It's believed the pangolin could have been the intermediate host for COVID-19, with the market's unsanitary conditions allowing the virus to
transfer from human to human.
And it wouldn't be the first time a virus has found its way from animals to humans there.
These markets were the likely source of SARS in 2002, 2003, avian influenza A in 2013, and now arguably COVID-19. That's a disconcerting track record over just the past 17 years.
After the SARS virus outbreak in 2002, which is believed to have passed from bats to civet cats to humans in a wet market, China placed a ban on the wildlife trade, but it was short-lived. The thing that I don't understand is why then do they not put regulations in place to clamp down on wet markets?
If the Chinese government is able to track discussions among doctors in a private chat room, it's more than capable of tracking what happens in wet markets. It's unfortunately a matter of priorities.
Following the outbreak of COVID-19, Huanan's seafood market was shut down and another wildlife trade ban was put in place. But Professor Carrico says there was a crucial flaw.
Again, there was an exception for purposes of Chinese medicine. So that is a bit of a contradiction because people are, of course, not eating pangolin or civet cats because they're particularly tasty delicacies. So to include an exemption on the wildlife trade ban is essentially to make the ban itself completely useless.
So what you're saying then is it could happen again?
Oh, it certainly could happen again. It's really almost like a ticking time bomb. Every time an animal is slaughtered in one of these environments, you're really essentially gambling on the health of humanity.
While the wildlife trade wasn't regulated at the time of the outbreak, there's been no conclusive proof that COVID-19 originated from the Huanan seafood market. An independent analysis of the initial cases shows the majority did have direct contact with the market, but not all had. To some people, this means the virus might have come from somewhere else, somewhere more sinister.
Part 3, The Lab.
I do think COVID-19 has been surprising.
This is Dr. Emma Hodcroft, a molecular epidemiologist at the University of Basel in Switzerland.
It's the pandemic that we feared, but that we certainly hoped would never come.
A conspiracy has been circulating that the virus came from a Chinese laboratory. It's especially popular in America and has even been promoted by the president. Here's Donald Trump taking a question from a journalist at a White House press briefing.
Have you seen anything at this point that gives you a high degree of confidence that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was the origin of this virus?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have.
The Wuhan Institute of Virology is one of China's national biosafety labs. It researches bat-related coronaviruses. It's also located a few miles from the Huanan seafood market.
There's scientific labs all over the world. It doesn't really mean anything that one is near a live food market.
She admits that currently there's a lot of international tension between countries, and people may raise the question about whether the virus appearing was unlucky or whether...
You know, was this a malicious act?
What is the evidence to disprove that the virus came out of the lab?
This sounds a little bit crude to say, but if you wanted to make a virus that was going to infect lots of people and cause lots of damage, there's a good chance you wouldn't pick coronavirus.
Why? Because, she says, we're just not familiar with it. Rather, you'd pick something like flu, which scientists understand and could be manipulated to do great harm. What I think you're saying is that it's very difficult to make this kind of coronavirus by human hand.
Yes, I think that unfortunately there's a bit of a perception that us scientists can very easily take a virus and make a few changes and, oh, now it's really, really dangerous. But in reality, that's very, very difficult.
Scientists agree the virus wasn't created by humans, but could a pathogen accidentally have been released? Wuhan's Institute of Virology has the highest grade 4 security rating as it handles such dangerous viruses. An accidental leak would be difficult, and there's never been any evidence it came from the lab. It's time, she says, to take the politics out of science.
weighing in on conspiracy theories can be more harmful than helpful. There's often other agendas involved. This is rarely based in science.
Dr. Hodcroft is also co-founder of Next Strain, an open source project which tracks pathogen evolution in real time. She's been monitoring the coronavirus since early January, when China released its genetic sequence. Having the genome at the very start of the epidemic meant scientists like Dr. Hodcroft could quickly get to work studying the sequences from Wuhan. They found that they were identical, and a few had one or two mutations.
This is exactly what we expect from a virus that hasn't been in humans very long. It just hasn't had time to diversify. It's a very new, young virus. And this backs up the epidemiological evidence that this virus probably jumped into humans at the end of 2019. And this happened in one location, because all of the samples since then trace back to this common ancestor in China.
So the scientific evidence points to COVID-19 jumping from animals into humans in a situation of close proximity. One way to dispel conspiracy theories and pinpoint the origins of COVID-19, as well as assessing China's handling, would be to have a proper, independent inquiry.
Part 4. China's Chernobyl.
In December, I was already hearing some news on China.
Our final expert witness is Steve Tsang. He's professor of Chinese studies and director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London.
That what was then called an atypical pneumonia was developing in Wuhan.
China failed to tell the world about the virus when it was developing, but there's another charge that since it's continued to be limited with its international cooperation. Last month, Australia called for an independent inquiry into how the virus started and was handled by China. Beijing was furious, accusing them of political manoeuvring and threatened trade sanctions. Steve Tsang acknowledges that China hasn't been completely transparent, but
China has been a lot more cooperative than when SARS happened 17 years ago.
Still, its approach to engaging with the world has been, he says, on its own terms.
The Chinese government was very focused to make sure that the narrative about COVID-19 would not be allowed to develop into a way which will put the Chinese government primarily responsible for a global pandemic.
The Chinese Communist Party has tried to control the narrative by spreading two key messages. First is directed domestically, and he says is basically truthful, that
China has managed to contain and confront COVID-19 much more effectively than democracies, which implicitly shows the superiority of the Chinese Communist Party system.
But the second
is to confuse people in terms of how the virus developed and took hold.
It's why, he says, the Chinese government's propaganda machine has gone into overdrive to explain the origins of COVID-19, even suggesting it came from abroad.
The Communist Party is not willing for independent investigations to take place because they cannot guarantee its funding will uphold the Communist Party and the leadership of Xi Jinping.
Because, he says, they fear a threat to their very legitimacy. Since the collapse of communism in the USSR and Eastern Europe, its survival has been based on a deal with the Chinese people.
That under the leadership of the Communist Party, it will deliver a better tomorrow, even though in return, the Communist Party will claim a monopoly of power in China itself.
So when human-to-human transmission was finally confirmed, after weeks of denials, many in China questioned whether the state could deliver on its promise after all.
And this is the moment when people talk about the Chernobyl moment, a turning point for developments in China. That's why it's very, very important for them in this moment of crisis when doubts were being expressed about the leadership of the party to make sure that people in China do not blame the Communist Party for it. It's the evil outsiders, Westerners, who are trying to blame China for their own failings. And we, heroic Chinese, must rally round the flag and defend the honour of China.
China has now agreed to a broader review into COVID-19 led by the World Health Organization once the crisis has passed, which will likely include the global response. Professor Tsang expects this review won't be as probing as the one Australia first demanded, and China's closeness to the WHO could be another reason why they consented.
It seems reasonable to assume the WHO investigation will not go beyond what the Chinese government will find it agreeable.
The truth, though, is we just don't know precisely where the virus started, who knew what, and how it was then handled, which is why Professor Tsang says the fully independent inquiry is so essential. There were, of course, things China could have done differently, but even so, other countries must accept responsibility for their own mishandling of the pandemic.
And we cannot blame China for the complacency that our democratically elected leaders demonstrated in dealing with it. So even if the Chinese government had done all the right things, I don't think there is a cast iron guarantee that the pandemic would not have happened.
How far can the Chinese government be blamed for COVID-19? A SARS-like virus was known about from December, but covered up initially. The wildlife trade wasn't sufficiently regulated, making markets a potential breeding ground for transmissions of disease. And certainly the Chinese government could have been more open with the international community. But China did release the genome remarkably early and has shown with the Wuhan lockdown how countries could deal with the virus. Yes, China made grave mistakes, but Western governments can't blame it for failures of their own making. They had months to prepare, whereas China only had weeks. This edition of The Inquiry was presented by me, Kavita Puri. It was produced by Eleanor Biggs and was put together by Rod Farquhar. It was edited by Richard Varden.
Summer 1940. Adolf Hitler was poised to invade Britain. German bombers struck British factories, airfields, towns and cities. Stopping the onslaught took a very special plane. The best fighter plane in the world. The Spitfire. Before a plane could save a country, the people had to build it.
The enemy is making preparations for the invasion of Britain. How are we going to meet and overcome this danger?
The plane would be assembled in the communities it was designed to protect. Towns and villages were new Spitfire factories. The planes built by a fresh generation of young men and women. This is the story of the people who built the plane that won the war. Spitfire, the people's plane. A brand new podcast from the BBC World Service. Just search for Spitfire, the people's plane, wherever you get your podcasts.